Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 11th, 2020. This is the 10th week of our 12-week Truth of Happiness Dhamma study, and this week's talk is on the common hindrances to a Dhamma practice. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So we are nearing the end of our 2020 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. And this week we're looking at hindrances. Let me recap and put this right where it belongs in the progression of our study. We began with a look at the jhana meditation technique, how to do it. And then we looked at the four foundations of mindfulness, which is the refined mindfulness as it applies to the Dhamma. Very specific mindfulness we learned. And then we looked at the entire context for Dhamma practice, why we do this, the Four Noble Truths. And then for the next 3 weeks after that, we looked at the path for developing that understanding of Four Noble Truths and ending our ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Again, the purpose of Dhamma practice. Then we studied where and why we do this, meaning dependent origination. That teaches us, that is, from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of confusion, delusion, and ongoing stress and suffering arises. That describes the problem. And in that same week of study, we looked at the personal experience of suffering, known as the five clinging aggregates. Michael had a really great and subtle understanding of the connectedness between the five clinging aggregates and the immediacy of Dhamma practice, which leads us to last week's study of karma and rebirth, which is just that. The topics of karma and rebirth point to the immediacy of Dhamma practice right here, right now. The only place that, the only practical expression of Dhamma can be in the present moment. There's no Dhamma in the past. There can be none in the future. It's right here and right now. And so karma simply explains how that occurs. And it also informs what we're giving birth to in this moment. Now, the hindrances, to many, seem almost like a grammar school teaching on societal behavior. Don't act this way. But it's much, much more than that. And it's something that the Buddha taught consistently. It's often ignored because these hindrances are so common, meaning we all have them. But these five hindrances describe why we can't develop the Dhamma practice or why we struggle with Dhamma practice, because it is in the immediacy of the moment with a mind that is transitioning from a wrong view to a right view that these hindrances arise and are effective in diminishing our experience of Dhamma practice. What I mean by that is when we're not practicing the Dhamma, these same hindrances will be a burden in our normal human lives. But in Dhamma practice, they need to be recognized as much, much more than that. They're the actual barrier to developing awakening. And so again, I'm not overemphasizing the importance of recognizing the five hindrances as they arise. And now I'm going to read the from the book, but you'll see how that's what these hindrances are taught for, to recognize that when these hindrances are arising, this is the time for Dhamma practice. So let me read from the book. And you also see that this is a very clear instruction on where precisely to practice a Dhamma. In other words, the reason why the Buddha taught the five hindrances is because he understood this is, like I said before, this is the block, the common block to developing awakening. You could say that these hindrances, and I'll tell you what they are in just a minute if you don't know them, are what we cling to maintain ignorance. The second in the six factors of the Eightfold Path, right intention and right effort, gently support our overall Dhamma practice. Right intention sets our direction, right effort keeps us going. Maintaining the strong resolve of right intention and engaging in right effort will provide the framework needed to develop and maintain Dhamma practice. Right intention is holding in mind the intention to put aside clinging, aversion, and delusional thinking and to awaken to the true nature of reality. Being mindful of right intention and right effort, we make a commitment to meditation practice and developing our understanding of the Eightfold Path. And again, that's Dhamma practice. It's not just meditation, but it's not just an intellectual study of what Dhamma practice might look like, or a contextual look at, conceptual look at what it would be to be awakened. In other words, an awakened human being, we obviously would classify that awakened human being as loving and compassionate. And often the concept of being loving and compassionate is substituted. In other words, we create the fabrication that we can be that without developing the actual path to naturally being loving and compassionate human beings. I hope I'm making that clear. Much of modern Buddhism, like you could really call it much of the modern New Age thought, is to describe the ideal human being and then kind of pressure us with this underlying group New Age philosophy that that's what we should be. And the hurtfulness of that is that, and the Buddha recognized this 2,600 years ago, these same ideas of universal consciousness and a one mind theory of the world were just as prevalent during the Buddha's time. And they sound nice. They easily engage us, meaning they easily distract us. And so we've created very powerful and pervasive systems to describe that, and they're usually called religion, spirituality, philosophy, etc. And so while the conceptual idea of an awakened human being looks good, there's no path to getting there for most human beings. In other words, that's what the Buddha recognized as being rooted in ignorance. And so he taught an Eightfold Path to recognize what we're doing, realize these blocks to developing that, and these blocks that force us to create concepts of who we should be rather than simply recognize the reality of who we are and can't be anything else. Let me continue. Well, someone's trying to come in. Hold on, I gotta take a close look at this. And I think it's okay. I'm trying to screen people, but I have a hard time reading their name. Well, we'll see who that is. Oh, it's Mary. Hi, Mary. Okay. Let me just continue with this. The practical aspects of meditation and developing the Eightfold Path. Put aside times, preferably twice a day, for meditation practice. It is most effective to meditate as soon as possible after waking and before becoming disturbed or sidetracked by our daily routine. Now, the practical application of meditation as a counter to these hindrances is described in that instruction. It's best to start our day as early as possible with bringing our minds back into our bodies, establishing that concentration as the foundation for the rest of our day. And then as our day unfolds, we will have already inclined our minds to be mindful of these hindrances. Doing this consistently begins to diminish a continuous mind's need for distraction. Right effort, the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, is keeping ourselves in fit physical, mental, and spiritual condition as well. And that last line, spiritual condition, just means attending. And again, I'm using that in a very broad application. It just means attending to our well-being in a general way. Sometimes when people take up a path like this, they'll expect that the path themselves, meaning just being engaged in the so-called religion of Buddhism, will solve all their problems. And so you don't need to take care of yourself physically. You don't even really have to think too much about what you're opening yourself up to as far as maybe watching too many movies or something like that. You're simply not mindful of it because, well, I'm practicing Buddhism, so I'm good to go. Much like we're taught, I don't want to go there on Easter weekend, we learn that we have to practically apply this. It's again, it's not a concept. And again, it's at these hindrances that we actually practice this. Lost my spot. Keeping yourself in fit physical, mental, and spiritual conditions as well. Getting enough rest, eating healthy, and physical exercise are a part of right effort. Any exercise is support for Dhamma practice, and walking, and I use this in quotes, meditation is a very skillful way to combine exercise and mindful movement. Tai Chi, and I say that because walking, even though it's called meditation, it's not meditation as we understand meditation. Meditation is practice sitting secluded from the world and doing that one thing. Being mindful when you're walking is not a substitute for that. It doesn't achieve the same deepening levels of concentration, but it is a walking, so-called walking meditation, which is really just mindful walking, is a consequence of right meditation practice. In other words, a right Dhamma practice. We are naturally engaging in mindful walking as we develop the Dhamma, much like we are engaging in mindful driving or mindful dishwashing or mindful discourse or mindful horseback riding or mindful golf. It's not making a meditation out of those activities. It's bringing refined mindfulness to those activities. And again, and the it may seem like an insignificant point, but from where I'm sitting, it used to be surprising. It's no longer how many people describe their meditation practice just that way. That, oh, I go here and I take a walk every day. That's my meditation practice. And that is reaffirmed by so many people that becomes the norm. And so it's important to recognize all of those things are simply an expression of inner refined mindfulness. Tai Chi and Qigong are particularly supportive of Dhamma practice, and especially the way our friend Matt teaches it. And that's why we incorporate it on our retreats. And I really, I know I say this often, the third Saturday of every month, once we open up again in Trenton and in Frenchtown, come to Matt's class. It really is amazing. And remind me to talk a little bit about our 2020 retreats if I fail to mention it. It looks like I'm going to close. Keep in mind that there is no effective substitute for sitting meditation. Bringing the body to stillness greatly supports a calm and tranquil mind. These are the five common hindrances to Dhamma practice. Sensory or sensual desire. I'm going to read them through and then I'm going to go back to them. Ill will. Sloth or laziness, torpor, or drowsiness. Restlessness and worry, doubt, uncertainty, or skepticism. The first, sensory or sensual desire, that is the common problem. And it's what is addressed when we're focused on the Dhamma at the point of contact. Because it's in this moment that my mind is either distracted by the need for continued sensory distraction, sensory stimulation, or I have regained control of my mind and I'm no longer seeking that. So the first hindrance to practice, and it's the probably the first thing for most people that arises during meditation as a hindrance, as something that's saying, get off my cushion, I can't do this anymore, is the immediate need for distraction. And I would bet we've all experienced that. We decide we're going to be grand meditators, we find a place to do it, we find a method and we start doing it. As soon as we close our eyes, our mind says, wait a minute, I need to talk to that person. What's going on at work tomorrow? How come my cat is doing, what is going on here? How can I have, what, when am I going to get my new, all those things that keep coming up and churning in our minds, come back. That's the need for constant sensory stimulation. We need to keep the story that we've initiated the moment we're born going in our minds, so that we don't have to face the fact that we don't know who we are, ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And it works very well. It works so well that we've been doing it since the beginning of time. It's what the Buddha recognized upon his awakening. You remember in the Nagara Sutta, he's describing that feedback loop of being stuck in just that thing and not being able to extricate himself from his own ignorance because of these five hindrances. So in the immediate need, when we find ourselves sitting in meditation, and we can't sit in that moment, it's because in that moment we can't stand the boredom of meditation. It seems boring, but boredom is simply the immediate need for stimulation right here, right now, rather than regaining control of our minds, taking a breath in that moment, bringing our minds back into our bodies, and being at peace with that. And in the next moment, for most of us, we're likely, to use the phrase, lose our mind again towards that sensory stimulation. And what we do at that point is take a breath and come back into our bodies. But that's not the only hindrance. Ill will, is the second, and it's something that is so pervasive that there's great importance in putting it kind of at this second position. Most of us as functioning human beings don't live with constant hatred towards other people. You really can't live a life that way, or you become very psychotic, even if it's just focused in an immediate area. I'm making myself clear about this. It's really the ill will that we mostly project on other people is really ill will that we feel against ourselves because of ignorance of Four Noble Truths, because we don't understand ourselves. And because we don't truly understand ourselves, we establish a life that is uncertain because of that understanding. And because of that understanding, we feel that there's something lacking, and often we'll take that a little bit further. Because of that lack, there's something broken or wrong with us. And so you've heard me say this over and over again. I've been trying to write this book in Dhamma terms for quite a few years, that the underlying human problem that's rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is self-loathing, which another way for that is self-ill will. And so as we deepen the Dhamma, and I bet you every one of you would agree with this, but it's true. As we deepen the Dhamma, we realize that how we're applying the Dhamma is at that point of self-loathing, of ill will, of I'm not good enough. I need more. I need special knowledge. I need a special intervention from some disincarnate beings to take care of me because I'm not good enough. The Buddha realized the cruelty of that. That was, again, the common teachings of his time, just as our times, that there's something wrong with us and we need something outside of ourselves, or some bit of knowledge, or some amulet, some piece of crystal, the right diet. We need something to fix us. And the Buddha realized that's all nonsense. It's all rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, because nothing can fix us, because nothing is broken. We're simply human beings having a human life. Birth, sickness, aging, and death. Not getting what we want is disappointing. Getting what we don't want is disappointing. In short, the five clinging aggregates are that nature of suffering. I'm reminding you because that's bringing us right back into this present moment. And in that present moment, connecting these first two hindrances, because of this need to constantly fix myself, I'm always distracted by the sensory stimulation of finding that thing that will fix myself or resolve my problem. The next piece of chocolate cake, a new sweater, a new relationship, whatever it might be. These are all substitutes for that initial ill will towards me. I'm not good enough. The third is laziness or torpor, the same thing, or drowsiness. And those are two slightly different things. Many people who are, now I'm just talking about as this relates to Dhamma practice. Many people give up their Dhamma practice because they're simply too lazy to do it. It does take a certain amount of effort. That's why that's there. Because again, a mind rooted in ignorance that's doing everything it can to continue to ignore that ignorance will create these types of feelings of just not wanting to do it, lackadaisical. That's an aspect of the resistance to awakening. And a similar aspect of that is drowsiness. And many people feel that even in meditation. And in fact, I hear this often from beginning meditators, that they find themselves falling asleep or wanting to fall asleep during meditation. That is very common, and it's simply a resistance to awakening. In other words, falling asleep, when you think about that in that moment, is the perfect foil to awakening, isn't it? It's just the opposite. And our bodies compensate ourselves for that resistance by making us very drowsy. Now, there also might be a physical component of that that should be looked at. If you find yourself always falling off during your meditation, you might not be getting enough sleep. So what's the practical solution? Is get more sleep so you can meditate more appropriately, more effectively. Restlessness and worry kind of ties into that first hindrance. In this moment when I need constant stimulation and I'm not getting it, I'm going to be restless and I'll be worried about something in my life, and I'll usually apply it to one object or one event or a series of those things that I need to worry about. And that becomes a very effective tool in distracting myself from what I no longer want to face, my ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And that often results in verifiable medical conditions. Anxiety is a debilitating mental condition that there was a time in my life during my addiction and even shortly thereafter where I was so full of that worry and self-doubt that I really couldn't function. I had to go on medication in order to get through it. I had to get off the medication to actually eventually get through that. And I've many people who suffer with anxiety. And I don't think there's many people in the world that get through not being anxious about things, but I'm talking about clinical anxiety, have developed the Dhamma and have done very well. And I don't know that I would have been able to get off. And I'm going back, how old am I? Almost 40 years. But I don't think I would have been able to get off of the medications I was on if it wasn't for even the rudimentary meditation practice that I had. At least it allowed me in a very minor way to start regaining control of my mind. And that allowed me to get off of the medication. And I'm not telling anyone to get off your medication and just meditate. That's very dangerous. The last is doubt and uncertainty. Or skepticism. And this, again, when you look at it clearly, relates to everything about the Dhamma and the three marks of existence. In other words, a significant aspect of impermanence is uncertainty. Because everything is impermanent, we can never be certain what the next moment is going to bring. And a mind that is confused will often be distracted towards the lack of control that they have over their thoughts. In other words, I keep churning up these things that are stressful to me. We don't realize we're doing it. But that makes us, again, fearful and doubtful of our own thoughts and our own ability to regain control of our thinking. Excuse me. So there's great doubt and uncertainty about our moment-by-moment life. Probably nothing better exemplified than this COVID-19 and how it emerged. But that, again, the real problem is not being comfortable within our own skin and comfortable within our own minds and being doubtful and uncertain about our next thought. And this is a rather subtle development. But when we really understand that it's our thoughts that are making us crazy, it's our thoughts that are distracting us, it's our thoughts that are maintaining ignorance, we can understand that it's our thoughts that make us uncertain and doubtful, even about the Dhamma, which is really being doubtful and uncertain about my own abilities to continue. So again, look at how the Buddha taught this and how I hope I'm teaching it. These are all practical teachings on what to be mindful of in developing the Dhamma and what is a true hindrance to practice. Because if we're giving in to any one of these five things or all five of them at the same time, there's no opportunity for Dhamma practice, save for recognizing that we're caught up in a hindrance. And then we know what we do. We don't analyze it. We don't spend too much time even ruminating over it. We're very gentle with ourselves. We recognize that in this moment, I'm caught in worry and self-doubt. Or I need some distraction in this moment. Or I just can't get rid of this hurtful thought towards my neighbor or towards myself. We take a breath. We bring our minds back in our body. And we realize that's just a fabrication rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And that brings us, that develops the next thought that we all talk about here, is how fortunate we are to have a direct and simple path to recognize and abandon each and every one of these hindrances. And so I want to stop there. I'm going to give this same talk again on Tuesday. But right at the end of that, I think is an important point to stop. We'll go around the room. So I hope you got something out of this talk. Let me start with Michael and Julia. Michael, how are you? And I'll let you all unmute your mics, I hope.
Sorry about that.
How are you, Michael?
I'm doing pretty good, John. We're doing pretty good, actually. We try not to get too distracted or, during these times. And try not to, we try to distance ourselves from a little bit from it. It's just too much news all the time. And obviously, that's leading up to, this is a, the Dhamma is such a, but a Sangha is such a great place for refuge, you know, and we find that, and it's, it makes us feel good to be here with everyone else.
Yeah. You know?
Okay. I just, I had written a poem that I'm going to read here, and probably, it's kind of tied into what we're talking about. And so I'll just read it, and then I'll go through the interpretation of it. But I just wrote this last night, okay? Okay, here we go. Watch him as he goes with the light in his eye, only to be replaced by sadness in his eyes. Watch him as he enters the fray of yet another lost day. He laughs, he cries, is born again, and dies, and does so a thousand times, a thousand times. Until his eyes open, for unless his eyes open, he will never be lost, forever craving that which does not exist, a place to call his own in this forever changing world. And who is that we see? Who is this poor soul who struggles so to and fro as he goes? Is it anyone that I know? I don't think so. So then tell me what you already know. He who you see is you and me. Okay? And
beautiful, Michael.
I'll explain that as I see it. The one thing I've gotten from the hindrances and the aggregates and the hindrances in this part of our study here is I understand now disenchantment and dispassion for those things that create a problem for us, you know, our Dhamma practice and our focus. So I understand, and I've become disenchanted, or I understand disenchantment, and I understand dispassion, all right? And that disenchantment and dispassion, okay, enables us to it creates almost like a separation between us and who we used to be before we started this path that we're on, this the Eightfold Path. And the other thing that I think it's an extremely important part of this is, and what I think is like one of the main teachings that the Buddha intended for us to grasp while in our studying, especially with the aggregates. And I think that is like what I have gotten from it is that the main thing I've gotten from the aggregates is that it shows us how to be compassionate. Compassion is a message that's interwoven in when we become disenchanted with the aggregates. Because when we become disenchanted, we can see others suffering. We can see others suffering who aren't aware of the Dhamma or aren't practicing who aren't on this path. And when we see those others in our daily lives, we can have compassion towards them because that is who we used to be. That is who, and we recognize that. So there's a recognition of who we used to be and who we are now as we develop and evolve Dhamma practice. So that's what I got out of that, and that's basically what I was trying to impart in the poem. So.
Beautiful, Michael. In order to have true compassion for another human being, we have to understand the nature of suffering, don't we? We have to understand the first noble truth, and in order to do that, we have to apply it first to ourselves and be self. And it's the true path of self-compassion is developing a Dhamma because we understand ourselves. Thank you. How are you this morning, Julia?
Very good, John. Thank you so much.
I think my voice sounded like I was kind of yelling over to you. It was a little bit louder than it needed to be. So, good morning, Julia.
Good morning. I had like an experience the other day. Usually, I don't like to be so self-referential, but this applies kind of to the hindrances. So, especially with ill will. At first, I wasn't really reading in the chapter in the book. Explains ill will very well, because it doesn't mean like you want to kill somebody or something, some kind of like bad, ill you know, things like that. But it, I think it means a lot also is when sometimes when something happens to you where somebody maybe is angry, you know, angered at you for some reason, or and you also feel anger back or resentment, and you know, that doesn't mean that you want to hurt them, but I started to understand it more so because the other day I had an experience where a parent had written a letter to an administrator about my teaching. And at first, looking at, you know, seeing the letter, and I said, you know, clearly this person doesn't understand, you know, what they're talking about. And so I started to take it personal, and then I realized I'm taking this very, very personal. And I started to realize, I had to take a breath. I had to take several breaths. Because I started to realize the person's confusion and the state of being that we're all in, and that the person was hurting, you know, and that there was a lot of fear and not understanding that the system of being online for her child and, you know, all these different things. And mostly, though, I realized that the person had a lot of confusion with what was going on in the world, just like I had confusion also. And so I was taking... I started to feel a little resentment there. So I sat down and I did a 10-minute meditation, and I said, I'm going to respond to this, but I'm going to respond to this from my core being, you know, with loving kindness, not with more confusion, you know? And I did realize we were just reading this chapter with the hindrances, and I did realize, this is ill will. This is what this is. And this is how I'm to understand this and catch myself, you know. Of course, I caught myself a little later. I went off the first night, you know, you let yourself get involved sometimes. But I was able to hold myself back and not respond. And so I sat down, I meditated for 10 minutes. And then I said, I'm just going to, you know, just put this aside. And then later I went and I wrote a letter explaining actually that the person was, you know, this person was confused. I knew that she was, and I knew that once I wrote this, that she would understand the lessons that were on, and that her daughter had completed most of them, that, you know, there was no confusion. And I was able to write something that was from compassion, you know, something that was with understanding for the situation. So I appreciated the fact that the teaching, because it allows me to recognize that in myself. That's very necessary. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Julia. What a just a beautiful example of authentic Dhamma practice. You just described, you described the whole path in that experience. And the first of all, just recognizing that it's arising within you, this need for this person to be different than they are. And then taking responsibility for it, realize where it's coming from, and then being able to understand them and their actions because you now understand yourself. You know, that's the essence of Dhamma practice. It's the essence of true compassion. And, you know, an important point to see here is that you were able to maintain a calm and peaceful mind throughout that whole process, where in the past you would have lost your mind over it and you would have been angry at that person.
yes,
I mean, but that's common. It's not because there's something wrong with you. That's what we all do as human beings. We blame others for the way we feel, which goes against the four foundations of mindfulness, doesn't it? We learn to take responsibility. It's not that person that is making me feel this way. It's my reaction. It's me wanting that person to be different than they are. And there's a, you know, to even to think that this person should be any different is misunderstanding the fact that I don't understand why they're talking that way, why they're acting that way. But the Dhamma gives us that understanding. We know why people act the way they act, and we are able to engage in true compassion that way. Thank you. What a great example. Hello, Lorna. You want me to unmute you?
No, I'm good now.
There you are. How are you, Lorna?
Hi, good morning, everyone. I don't really think of anything much to add today, but we all get caught up in hindrances. At least recognize them, the happening, and just try and work around them. I sometimes don't all my hindrances head on. For instance, if I really am very distracted in a meditation, I can leave my meditation and come back another time. Mm. And that doesn't bother me at all. I think the goal is not to, in a way, pick a fight. It's to accept that the hindrances are there. And you just do your best to work around them in a gentle way towards yourself.
Yeah.
In a day-to-day, when I sit on my cushion, I try to come to the cushion knowing that I'm a big heap, meaning the five clinging aggregates. Yep. I'm a big heap. I try to leave my cushion recognizing I'm a smaller heap than when I arrive. And then that then follows through that in your day-to-day life, that because you are believing that you're a smaller heap, things don't bother you quite so much as they would have done it earlier in your practice. And that's sort of really how I approach my practice, just to diminish the heap of five clinging aggregates that we think we are. We can't, as I say, we can't always get there all the time, 24/7, on the cushion or off the cushion. I can't do that for sure. If I can't do that, I can't do that right now. But I understand that diminishing the heap diminishes the judgment we have about our lives. Yeah. as we go through our lives, and that's what you know, that's the Dharma practice as far as I see it anyway, that and then we just go in the flow with life as life occurs. Yeah. and we are not resisting life as life unfolds, or we're not agreeing with it, or whatever. It's just life, and life as it is. And that's how I approach my Dharma practice. But yeah, the hindrances get me, and as I say, I don't always, you know, go at them head on. I can't. I don't know if it's, maybe I should. Maybe I should be a bit more you know, a bit more stand up to them and add a bit more pressure to myself to get through this. But, you know, I tend not to, actually.
Thank you, Lord. It sounds like you're doing it perfectly. And I'm going to change the title of the book from Becoming Buddha to Becoming Little Heaps. Good to see you this morning. Hello, Ram.
Yeah. Hello.
Good morning.
There you are.
We are here in the Little Book Command Center. I like that, Mike. The thing that struck me in this chapter was actually doubt, uncertainty, and skepticism. Because in a way, specifically, skepticism has been really important in my life. In the very early days of my life, it got me out of being an altar boy. And further on in my other previous practices, it actually allowed me to recognize that those practices weren't working. And what the one sentence that really jumped out in the chapter was where you said to examine your motives, and you said specifically in in your practice. But that's always been a very important way for me to make sure that I was on the right track. And even when I first came to to the Sangha and to your classes, I approached it with a lot of skepticism. And it wasn't until, of course, until the skepticism finally fell away that my practice really took off and getting integrated. But this thing of questioning your motives is still an important thing. Because it's easy, it's just so easy to fool yourself that everything's hunky-dory and your practice is just going great. And it's not until you keep throwing that right intent in there. You need to question, what is my intent here?
Yeah. And that's the better word to use as opposed to motives, but yeah.
You know, I can apply it to, you know, when I look at other people's motives and intent as well, you know, that's a good way to look at people. You know, what is their intent in life? But frankly, it all, again, comes down to what is your own intent here? And if that, if you don't keep a sharp eye on that, it's very easy to get lazy in your practice. We got it together. It's all fine. You know? And then, you know, you get a little challenge in your life, and that's where you get to see, you know, when practicing metta is difficult. Look at your intent at this point.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Thank you so much. It is, and it relates directly to countering these hindrances and remembering the second and sixth factors of the Eightfold Path, right intention and right effort are the immediate, the whole Eightfold Path is, but it's the immediate counter to when this occurs. What is my intention here? And let me continue to engage in the right effort. And it's also important to remember that the Buddha is not saying we should never be skeptical of anything we ever hear. Everything the Buddha taught was in the context of the Dhamma. In other words, if in this moment I'm skeptical that jhana meditation and the Eightfold Path is going to give me what I want, it means that I haven't truly taken true refuge in the Dhamma. I'm still skeptical about it. But taking true refuge simply means understanding that a human being did this, he taught us how to do it, and we have the support of this wonderful Sangha that we're all a part of. And that's, by the way, is going to be the theme of the retreat that I want to talk about, but I'll do that later. But it's skepticism as it relates to the Dhamma. When I do listen to the news, I'm pretty skeptical about what I'm being told. But that has nothing to do with the Dhamma. It has to do with what's going on in the world. I'm no longer, for many, many years, especially out there in all the different forms of modern Buddhism, I was skeptical every day. I didn't even notice it because it was never taught that I should be noticing it. I just thought that being skeptical was part of practice. In fact, there's a, and I'm not going to go too far into it by naming it, but there's a modern tradition that actually encourages and teaches to cultivate doubt, that that's actually part of practice as a way of understanding doubt, which is, again, it's just overanalysis. The Buddha recognized that again. He said, if you're doubtful within the framework of the Dhamma, recognize it and put it aside and come back to the Dhamma. So, thank you, Ram. Who's over here? Is that Laura? Hello, Laura. How, want me to unmute you? I will. I think I did. Laura?
Hello, everyone.
Good morning.
Well, you know, I think what I recognize in this teaching is how intertwined the hindrances can be, you know, how one leads to another, you know, for example, you know, just the uncertainty of life these days, that experience and where that draws my thoughts, you know, then leads to kind of this ill will towards myself and my capacities and capabilities. And so, yeah, I can really see the strength of the Dhamma in the practice. Just the kind of the importance of the hindrances in the practice as this point of contact for continuing to recognize the path. Life is going to be a long journey, and I'm not, I think that the hindrances will be with me throughout life. I don't imagine that they'll disappear anytime soon. So, they're just kind of this constant reminder that to just that you're on the path. At least that's my experience of it. And I liked what Lorna was saying, and I do think that for me there is times where there's kind of an acceptance of just letting that a little bit of letting the hindrances kind of carry you away a bit, and accepting that this is just where you are on the path, and that you'll be able to pick it up again, in a half hour later.
That's right. Yeah.
You have to be distracted for a while, because why add more stress, I think, sometimes? I think that's an interesting, those are interesting moments.
That's the Salada Sutta, the second arrow, good for you. I interrupt you, I'm sorry, Laura.
No, it's okay, but thank you.
Thank you. Again, when we're mindful of these hindrances, we're being mindful of present moment Dhamma practice, because it's in this moment that these hindrances will arise and that I can address them, meaning recognize them and simply abandon them. The Branhams are all good?
We're all good.
Good. Where's my friend Matt?
I have lots of practice on focusing my mind with all the...
tell them all I said hello. And that's Anthony. How are you, Anthony?
Good morning. Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone.
Good to see you.
You too. I appreciated the talk today. It was really, really nice for me. And I kind of focused a little bit more probably on the ill will hindrance, because I liked what you said, that ill will directed towards others is always ill will directed towards yourself, because it never feels right to attack back. And when I get into those situations, I always ask myself first, is that an accurate thing? Because if it's accurate, then I feel like I need to correct it. Yep. And if it's not accurate, then I need to understand it. So I really liked what Mike said about drawing on your own suffering to understand the suffering of others, because that's often a very useful thing to do. As you can imagine, as a lawyer, I get into a lot of situations of ill will because it's an adversarial profession, and it's common for people to fight and get angry and write nasty letters or emails or make nasty phone calls. And I used to fight back all the time. I would always try to be twice as bad as they were. And it never felt good. And now if I could draw the space, and I do draw the space, and I analyze my feelings and how I feel, how my body is reacting and what I'm thinking, it allows me to approach them with, directing the issue to where it needs to be directed to, but with kindness. And the ironic thing is that when I do that, I find that I get kindness back most of the time and not more fighting. So I think it's actually a very productive thing to meet ill will with kindness, but it also feels right and never makes you go away feeling hurt.
Anthony got me almost jumping out of my seat, because again, this is pure Dhamma practice, and if we can recognize that, the subtleties of what you just said, when I have, even if it's just an adverse thought, I don't have to express it, but I have an adverse thought about another human being, it feels awful, and you can't hide it from yourself, and so your next thought to compensate yourself and not beat yourself up over it is to then figure out a scheme to blame the other person, to make them responsible for your feeling. Do you see how this relates right back to the four foundations of mindfulness? Be mindful of feelings arising and passing away. That's what you describe. Instead of feelings arising, me making someone else responsible for my feeling and losing my mind over it. And the good example of that is because of the thought that now I have to blame you for how I feel. Now I got to create and fabricate a scenario, an ongoing scenario to maintain that, to use the strong word, hatred. But it all is pointed back at me, isn't it? And the way that something made me feel. And it's at that point again, the five hindrances were there. Practice the Dhamma right there. Beautifully said. Thank you. And Tim, how are you?
John.
Good to see you.
Hello, Sangha. How's everybody?
Good. Everybody's doing well.
I almost didn't come to class today because of being very agitated, and I'm always very honest with the Sangha.
You are.
However, the hindrances are something that, which everybody so far has said, is something that we confront all the time in our day-to-day living. So, and I always do read the chapters, and I always do meditate, because the jhana is the thing that the Dhamma practice is the thing that, especially during these times, is the thing that holds us together, so we don't lose our minds over what's happening at this moment. So I wrote this down in my notes. They're rather Jack Kerouac-ish, where they're not really, so excuse the run-on sentences and the lack of commas and periods. But basically, I wrote...
You've learned a lot from my writing.
I'm learning from you, John. Conditioned thinking developed from past experiences justify, in our mind, ill will, doubt, and skepticism, which are hindrances. Anxiety is a reaction to these doubts and worries, concerns, and skepticism. Conditioned thinking developed through social mores justify these sensual desires that we seek out. In short, the hindrances are roadblocks to right view or wise discernment, as the supplemental sutras you provided mention, and the three factors of the Eightfold Path. Hindrances are the manifestations of the impermanent life that we live without understanding the Four Noble Truths, being ignorant of the true meaning of life is, and that is, and through that, I have in caps, the most important thing, I think, at least introspectively, is for me to be very aware of the quality of my mind when I start going down that rabbit hole, and to stop, take that breath, and I don't care if I'm in the middle of a meeting, I'm going to stop, and I'm going to go on my cushion. And I'm going to get that peace of mind back. Because right now, things are moving, and you're starting to see things unravel in society. And this is a time to be very aware of your quality of mind and practice the Dhamma. Because it's going to be the thing that keeps us together and not exhibit any ill will towards people and to the things I just said. So that's kind of where I am now. And I'm sorry for the disjointedness of it, because it kind of is, but that's what I'm getting out of it.
Yeah. Tim, thank you. Very eloquent. What I'm most struck by what you said, and really what we're all talking about, is what today's talk is about. We're all talking about the immediacy of applying the Dhamma to what is occurring in the world. In other words, we're not getting together on a Saturday morning and praying to Avalokiteshvara to save us. And I'm not putting all these things down. We're not doing a one-hour drumming circle hoping to influence the coronavirus in some way. We're addressing the issue of what's occurring within my own mind and within a framework of Dhamma practice. And it really is remarkable. I say this often, but I've been in the Buddhist scheme for many, many, many years, and I've never experienced something collectively like this. It really is remarkable. And you're all, and you know, I'm sure it's going to continue. So maybe we'll be a little mindful of that, of how practically applicable the Dhamma is and how we're all applying it practically. So wonderful. Who's Jen, how are you?
Hi, everybody. I really like what Tim said, and I feel like ultimately what you're saying, Tim, is really controlling our mind is the only thing we can do.
Yep.
That is the only thing we can do, is control our own minds. We don't have control over anything else. We think we do, we don't. But before Tim spoke, I was thinking about just how skillful it is, of course, John, that you put this chapter at the end of the book, because I do think that you need to have your feet under you a little bit. Terms of Dhamma practice, to be able to recognize or understand what the hindrances really are.
Yeah.
You have to sort of have the big obstacles with the landscape of your own mind to be gone or calmer or clearer, to be able to recognize the hindrances, which
ultimately
you can hold up anything that you're thinking about up against the hindrances, especially if you notice that you have an agitated mind or even a distracted mind, which at least to me is sort of a subtler version of agitated. And if you notice that you're distracted, you can hold up whatever it is you're thinking about against the hindrances, and it will be one of those hindrances.
Yeah.
I think that's my understanding of it. Is if you're thinking about not what's happening right now, if you're not mindfully present, there's a hindrance there.
Yeah.
And then if you can recognize it as a hindrance, then you can abandon it. It loses its power. That's what I need to be thinking about.
Yeah.
That's a hindrance. I don't need to be thinking about it because it's not part of the practice. It's not what's happening right now. It's not skillful.
Yeah. Wonderful. Again, just to be recognized and abandoned. And you're right that to teach the hindrances first, To teach hindrances to anything first would be what most modern practices do, don't they? They teach you that to overcome your own ill will towards others. Why, you must be compassionate to be a real Buddhist. But there's no path to getting there. And the Buddha recognized that as well. So, and hopefully the book reflects that we first have to understand the Dhamma so that we don't take the hindrances in a personal way, and so they simply become an even greater hindrance. We understand them now as something that is impersonal and we're dispassionate about. We simply recognize them, take a breath, and move on to the next moment. So, well said, Jen. And Kevin, how are you, Kevin? Want me to unmute you? I think you have to do it on your end. There you are.
Am I good now?
How are you, Kevin?
Very well, thank you.
It's good to see you.
Hello to everyone. So, John, I just want to say thanks for this course. Here we are at the end of the course again. We're all about to graduate again, so we're all fine now. But I've gotten so much a deeper understanding of the Dhamma each time you go through this course, and this is, for me, maybe the fourth time I've gone through it, from the course itself, and then from all the teachings that you bring us each week. So thank you for that. I was thinking a little bit about just understanding in a way. And it I was thinking about Becky's haiku, and you know, if that were the first thing that I ever heard on my first day of opening a book to learn about the Dhamma, I might have been very confused. It would have seemed very opaque. I might not have understood it. It would have been like a Zen koan, maybe, thinking, okay, you're making me confused. You're just trying to scare me out of trying to understand everything. But now, because of the course and with the course and all the supporting teachings, it becomes quite visible and it becomes quite enlightening. Yeah. So the teachings and the Dhamma have led us there.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. And you just described going from, as you were talking about Becky's poem, going from wrong view to right view. You know, at one point it was confusing because you were stuck in a lack of understanding of Four Noble Truths. And now you can see the beauty in that poem.
Yes.
It's just that way. And I am building a web page for our poetry. I think it's actually up there, but I got distracted by a few things. So send your poems in, folks. You know, the poems you've sent me are really just remarkable. So I think that'll be a nice addition to our Sangha to have that page up there. And the poems that I've been putting in the email, I'll put up on the web page too. So maybe we'll have a crossover meditation Sangha poetry book.
If I might add to then also Michael's poem today was beautiful.
Yeah, send it in, Michael.
And about the hindrances, each meditation session is a struggle and can be a struggle with the five hindrances. They keep arising. Each thought is somehow attached to one or more of the hindrances.
Yeah.
But deeper engagement with the Eightfold Path and with right concentration helps us to face this struggle. So thank you again, and thank you to all the Sangha.
Well said, Kevin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Who is that? I can't read the name. Ah, that's Tim. Tim, you've been there. Kevin's there. Who's this? Liz, how are you?
I'm doing fine. It's really nice to see all of you and to be with you.
It's good to see you.
This is a really good lesson for trying to quell ill will, and how I think we all know personally how having ill will can make us feel. So to just check in with ourselves and know that the quality of our mind isn't what it should be. I think most of us have learned enough from the program to know that there's a way out of that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I find the most valuable, is knowing that we don't have to carry the ill will, which is the second arrow, you know, to ourselves, and can have more peace of mind by following the Dhamma. So I'm very grateful for that. It's as if we've all been doing this for this moment, so that we can not lose our minds and just have some peace in our lives during a very difficult time. Mm-hmm. And I love what everyone said today, and I'm really glad that I popped in. So thank you.
We're glad you popped in too. How's Tom doing?
He's doing well.
Good.
He's doing well.
Yeah. Good to hear. And Bonnie?
Bonnie's doing well too. Good.
Tell her we all said hello.
Yeah, she's learning how to teach online. You know, it's difficult for teachers to teach that way if they're not used to it. So God bless all the teachers.
Yeah.
We had a small parade come through town 2 days ago that was all of the Franklin Township teachers in their cars with balloons on them, and then an ambulance and a fire engine with their lights going, and they came through to say hi to all the students in the township. Yeah. It's very sweet. I had to go inside because I kept getting tears in my eyes, so
yeah.
It was very sweet.
It is.
Lots of good things are happening.
I was thinking the same thing. There's so much bad news, and you hardly ever hear about. I mean, as a country, and I guess as a worldly society, we've really stepped up in our taking care and acknowledging those people that care for us in a remarkable way, and it's about time. So, thank you, Liz. Becky, how are you? Hello, Becky.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So helpful and good to hear what everyone has to say. Yeah. It's just a wonderful thing to hear everyone supporting the Sangha and supporting each other.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to say that I think it was very helpful to be reminded of the hindrances, and helpful to know that the Buddha defined them and taught about them because they're common to all Dhamma practitioners.
Yep.
And when they occur, they're not to be taken personally. And I wrote this down last night, and then a few minutes ago, John said the very same thing. And it just, when I read the chapter and when I realized that I was taking them personally and that they're not to be taken personally, that was really helpful last week. Yeah. And I also want to read the phrase that I highlighted during my reading this week, which is, practicing metta meditation is a skillful aid in releasing harsh judgments.
Yeah.
Practice metta whenever harsh judgments of yourself or others are making it difficult to quiet your mind.
Yeah.
Once your mind has quieted, use metta to resume jhana meditation. And that was just a really good reminder for me.
Yeah.
And since Kevin mentioned poetry, I did write another haiku, and right. I wasn't going to read it, but
read it.
I'm going
it. author.
Go for it.
Uncertainty is impermanence. Now. Now, just let it be.
That's great. Thank you.
Bravo.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone, for all of your thoughts. Yeah. And it's so nice to be here. So lovely to be here.
It is. I was thinking the same thing, and just how nice it is to just meditate with you. Does it feel the same as meditating here as it does in Frenchtown? It kind of does to me. I mean, it's nice to get together. Even if it is online, with this, that Dhamma connection is still there.
Yes.
And metta, you bring up another important point. Metta is not meant to just be once or twice a week for us. It is there for dealing with ill will and fear. And whenever you feel like that, it's a great addition to a meditation practice. If you're having trouble settling your mind in jhana, start with metta. You can even listen to one of the downloaded metta recordings too. It's just a very powerful way that the Buddha taught metta. One of these days I'll teach the story behind metta, but he taught it to a group of monks and nuns who were who couldn't practice anymore because of their own fear of others, their own irrational fear of the dark in the forest, and their harsh judgments of other practitioners. And he taught metta in that way so that they could practice. Again, not in a moral way, not that you're a bad person because you're holding ill will towards others. You just can't practice when you're that way. Thank you. Brett, how are you? What does that say? How come I can't quite read what that says? I don't know. Brett, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you for the teaching. I found it. When you were talking about the hindrances, that's kind of where my head was at.
And yeah.
So there was a little bit overwhelming for a second to realize that that's where I was at. but it was good. And it's just something to be aware of. And it was, yeah, thank you for your teaching and all the, you know, the suggestions or the, you know, the definition or the, you know, the adjectives just describing all the hindrances, and they were helpful to hear about. So thank you. And hi, everybody. And I'm going to leave after this, but good to be here.
Good to see you, Brett. Yeah, I mean, the hindrances are taught so they're not hindrances. That's what that's why they're there. So I'm glad you joined us. Mary, how are you?
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone. Yes, the meditation is really good. It is a lot like being there. And as I listen to everybody, I feel some of the same connectedness and emotions that I do when I'm with everybody live. So just answer to your question. I'm really humbled by many of the things that people have said today, because there is some profound understanding and application of the Dhamma. And I feel a sense of pride to be a part of all of this. So it's been very beneficial to listen to everyone this morning. I think the hindrances are, you know, certainly common to all of us. And maybe that's why other practices or approaches, or even some of the what feels like goodwill out there on social media or whatever during this time, starts at the hindrances, right? But without practice and without the Eightfold Path, there can be a lack of depth and context to actually living it and recognizing it, right? You can't recognize ill will as it as you start to experience it in your body if the place that you recognize it is after you've already caused it.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
So the beauty of the practice is in all the factors of the Eightfold Path, so you can recognize and you can make the right effort, et cetera, to recognize ill will, not take the second arrow. As many other people have said so eloquently this morning, stepping aside or going to do something else or choosing not to hit it head on, all of those things that people have said this morning are you know, very practical applications of the Dhamma. The interesting thing about the hindrances is that they are, I guess, like everything else, they're so nuanced that sometimes they're not anger, you know, sometimes they're very subtle, like you say, about self-loathing or maybe things that we've adapted as if they're normal.
Yeah.
You know, that I'm supposed to feel this way, or sometimes I feel this way or whatever, but to recognize them and understand that there's an option to not be self-loathing. And the key is to recognize it and let it go and then experience that. And then once you do, you want to maintain that rigor of living. So this has been really great. I didn't think I had anything to say this morning, but I do want to say thank you to everyone. This has been really helpful, and I'm so glad we're continuing to do this job.
Thank you, Mary. These beautiful words. I see David Lest that left us. He's doing okay?
Yes, he's doing great.
Please tell him we all said hello.
I will.
That's Kevin again. I talked to Kevin, right? Hello, Karen. Let me get.
Hi, everybody.
There you are. How are you?
Good. I'm great. Thank you so much. I had so much resonated for me today in your teaching, John. Thank you so much. And first, I'd really like to send appreciation to Michael for his poem. It literally brought tears to my eyes, and it made my heart swell with compassion for everyone. Especially all of you in the Sangha. John, when you were talking about self-loathing and, you know, the 40 years ago, those feelings that you had, and it brought me back too to another time where I didn't have a clue that that's what was really driving me.
Yeah.
You know, but it just took over my life, and it was so encouraging to hear that this is something that we all have. You know, it's not just something that I'm dealing with. It's something that we're all dealing with, and that it's okay. And I love when you said that the Buddha taught that there's nothing to fix because there's nothing broken. I love that.
Yeah.
So thank you for reminding me about the metta practice. You know, these times at home with close contact with others can be challenging, can kick up some feelings, maybe not so pleasant. And this whole talk today has really helped me to see the choices that I have in responding to certain things, and taking a breath, pausing, and recognizing what's really going on. So thank you so, so much for being here, everybody.
Thank you for joining us, Karen.
Thank you.
Oh, who's that? I can't read the name. Someone here.
Is it David? David Compton?
No, it's David's next. There's someone else. It looks like Laura or Larry or something. I can't read the name.
It's Laura.
Oh, all right, Laura. I already talked to you. How are you, David?
Good morning, everyone.
Good to talk to you again.
I can activate the camera because Tracy's here. She wants to wave, say hello to those who remember us from a few years ago.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone.
Hey.
Camera was obviously close.
Hey, yeah, watch that close contact. Oh, good.
It is, this is the second time we've tuned in via Zoom.
Oh,
in the past, because both of us work on a computer 9 to 10 hours a day, and we have meetings 4 to 6 hours a day. So, last thing I wanted to do was load up another net meeting application, but over time, we had started struggling with our own individual meditation without the support of the structure offered by this group. And I also missed the intellectual stimulation and the prompts to remember important things about the teaching. So having been working from home for 4 weeks, I loaded it up last weekend for the first time and joined. And of course, we're back again. So we won't belabor the point, and we're glad to be participating again.
And I am, and we all are too, David and Tracy. I'm so glad you're back. If you're reinvigorating your practice again, you know, just go easy on yourself. That's the key to Dhamma practice, is just being present with what's occurring and be very gentle with ourselves. So, a few just announcements before we finish with Meta, and I will leave the room open for a little bit after I stop the recording. I hope I started the recording. Anthony and Brett had a little bit of difficulty, and Anthony's still here. Anthony, is it that you didn't know the password, or you were having trouble using it?
I couldn't find the email that had the password.
Okay, but it worked once you had it.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it's on the website and it is in all the emails, but not always readily apparent. The our spring retreat, our Vipassana retreat, is rescheduled to the fall. And so we're going to have an online retreat that weekend. The theme will be True Refuge. And I think that's an appropriate theme for what we're all going through. It's going to begin on Friday evening and end on Sunday afternoon. We're going to have 6 sessions of about 1.5 to 2 hours each. We're going to have not just one teacher, we're going to have 5 teachers that weekend. Our 4 new teachers are going to teach each session. And I sent an email out this morning with more details about that, but I hope you can all join us. The those that were registered for our spring retreat will be given priority. I think we can only have about 24 people in this room just to make it manageable. So I'm asking everyone to just send me an email to register. And then a day or two before, I'll just say who's getting in and who's not. And we'll see what happens. If there's a much bigger response than that, maybe we'll put a couple retreats on. But I think it's a good time to do that. So that's what we're going to do. That's the announcement. Any other questions or comments that relate to our class this morning before we finish with Meta? Anyone?
I do. One thing.
Yes.
John.
Please.
It's Tim. I just wanted to, I forgot to mention to Julia and Anthony, I really appreciated what you both said. They were similar. That empathy that you showed to those people who are agitated that you confront. I mean, that's something that I often try to do as well. And I think that instead of that ill will, that negative response, that positive, empathetic response to understanding what that person that's giving you these hard words or whatever, to be able to understand what they're saying is very inspiring. So thank you.
Yeah, it is. We have developed into a very inspiring sangha, and I hear it all the time from people that they just listen to our recordings, and you know they're blown. Somebody said, and I can't remember if it was last Tuesday or last Saturday's class. He said, "Do you know that you have 16 teachers there?" And they're right. You know, we all have integrated the Dhamma to that level that we can express it in a really remarkable way. So we'll finish with Meta. Someone else?
Yeah, John. It's Lorna.
Lorna.
I can't believe we've got through this morning without anybody saying that hindrances are impermanent.
thank you, wise teacher.
to a stream enter, somebody who's entered the stream and is being knocked about with the boulders going down the, going down the river like we all are. To a stream enter, all the hindrances are impermanent.
Yeah.
And that's just, I'm just putting it out there to remind that.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, wise teacher. They are. The hindrances will always yield to gentle Dhamma pressure. Is there anyone else?
That's it.
All right. We'll finish with Metta as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture and position. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths, and take a moment to be mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on Metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.